They come from the bowels of hell.
The Dana Gould Hour.
Jungle worms and swamp rats run around your feet.
I bought a dog that killed a calf that ate the canary. What is truth?
And once again, welcome back.
Spring has sprung. The vaccines are out, the sun is shining, and my first thought every morning is not what damage the President of the United States may have wrought the night before. The times are a-changin'. How's that? My guest today is a very good friend of mine. She is a crazily talented woman. I have been a fan since before I started in comedy. She's one of the original Not Ready for Primetime players. Lorraine Newman is here. Lorraine has a new book out on Audible called May You Live in Interesting Times. It is a memoir not only of her time on Saturday Night Live, which in and of itself would be a complete book, but also her fascinating childhood growing up in LA in the 1960s, her time after Saturday Night Live, her career, identity, addiction. Lorraine has met everyone in show business, it seems, and recounts it all in her excellent book, May You Live in Interesting Times, on Audible. Check it out and thank me later. As for me, why not toddle on over to YouTube? Check out Hanging with Dr. Z. It is the combination of Planet of the Apes and Space Ghost Coast to Coast that America has been asking for. Hanging with Dr. Z. Check it out. That's all I'll say about it. Lastly, if you are a Patreon supporter of our show, we appreciate it. If not, check it out. Go to danagould.com, click on our Patreon banner, and become a Dana Gould Hour Sky Cadet. $5 a month, and you're a member. You get extra interview segments, audio segments. $5 a month. Become a Sky Cadet and get some stuff. The Patreon is what makes it possible to keep doing the show. And we appreciate your patronage. danagould.com. And now, it's on to our filthy business.
Tune in, it's a gas. It's the Dana Gould Hour Podcast.
The Dana Gould Hour. Free and worth it.
There are certain people in my life that I'm like amazed that I'm friends with. Many of them are musicians that I was like a giant fan of. Like the Pixies is a great example. I'm friends with the Pixies. And that to me is insane. I'm friends with Paul Rubens. That to me is insane. And by the way, not new friends. I've been friends for 10 years. I've known them a long time. And it's still like, you know, got an email from Paul Rubens. Okay, I guess I'm pretty cool. And my guest today absolutely falls into that category. And she has an excellent new book, a memoir called May You Live in Interesting Times, based on the Chinese curse. And we're going to talk about it today. Please welcome America's next door neighbor, Lorraine Newman.
This is the sound of my voice.
There you go. That was better.
It's actually not a Chinese curse. I found that out. It's ascribed to that, but that's not what it is. It was created by some Englishman.
Oh, really?
Yeah. But it has the same ironic intent.
And it does. But your book is interesting because it's on Audible.
Yes.
So tell people right out of the gate why your book is special, how your book is special. And then I'm going to start asking you some insane questions, because you are the one thing that I learned from this book that I did not know is that you are the Forrest Gump of your generation.
I know. Zelig.
But it's true. But it's true. You go, you were as a teenager at the Beatles at Hollywood Bowl, and then you're driving around. You're killing time between scenes with the Rolling Stones. You're driving around El Segundo with Bill Murray. You're, you know, you, it's like every Hunter S. Thompson, all of these popular figures. You're like, oh, I was there. And as a member of the generation that came of age with your success, SNL premiered when I was 11 and I was an unsupervised child that started watching it from the get-go. And it formed, like everybody my age, it formed my sense of humor with Python. And you guys, I've made this analogy, but you guys were the Beatles to me in my adolescence. So,
I kind of feel like Stuart Sutcliffe.
I feel like the Pete Best of everything. So what your book allowed me to do was to see the world I was fantasizing about, like what it must be like to be on that show with those people at that time. And it is better than I had imagined.
Oh, I'm so glad.
And also more horrifying. And also as terrifying as when I became older, I assumed. So, but first of all, the book is on Audible. So tell people right out of the gate how to get your book.
Audible.com/Lorraine Newman. And if you're a member, it's a certain price. If you're not, I guess it's a different price. I'm not sure about that.
And you read the book. It's an audio book.
It is. Yes, it is a vocal performance. Yeah. And, you know, I took Mercy and a lot of my friends and sent them my manuscript so that they, if they had trouble, because it is 9 hours. I mean,
how long did it take you to do it?
4 days, 4 hour sessions.
That's fucking brutal.
I've done it before. I've done books on tape, but, you know, I gave myself a challenge because I wanted to do characters and dialects, which, mm-hmm. you know, are my passion, Dana. They're my passion. So, you know, I'm kind of meticulous that way, and I would want retakes if I didn't feel I'd gotten it right. So,
yeah, I talked to Steven Weber about when he recorded, I think he recorded The Stand or The Shining. That's what it was. It was It.
Yeah.
Thank you. And it was, I knew it was one of the doorstop books. And I just like, I cannot imagine that undertaking. Like,
yeah. Well, who's the actor from, Mad Men, the white haired actor? He does a lot of books on tape.
Oh, does he? I know who you're talking about. Roger Sterling, the guy that plays Roger Sterling.
Yeah. And,
He's a Boston guy. I can't think of his name.
Oh, no kidding. Well, this is terrible that we can't think of his name. But he does a lot of books on tape, and he did a Stephen King book called Duma Key. About a doorstop book. But his work on it is amazing because he's very subtle, and he'll change an inflection and maybe do a dialect here, but a very soft one. And he's instantly like a dowager Southern matriarch. And
John Slattery is the
actor. That's him. There you go.
Another masshole. Now, your book, if I were to describe your book to somebody, is that it, I would put it on the shelf next to Born Standing Up, Steve Martin's book.
Oh, my. Thanks.
They're good companions.
They are. There's a lot of confluence with those books.
But I like your book better, and I think your book is better because, unlike Steve Martin, and this is not ragging on Steve Martin, but unlike Steve Martin, you made more mistakes.
Oh, yeah.
And you're more flawed, or you're open about it, and you talk more about it. And this isn't a rag on Steve Martin that he didn't, you know, but like you read Born Standing Up, it's like, I felt like a fool. There I was, having bought the wrong flavor of chapstick. Like, well, that's not a bad thing.
I got a lot of
There's a piece in it, and we'll go back, and I want to talk about growing up in Beverly Hills next to, was it Hunts Hall or Leo Gorcy?
Leo Gorcy.
But there was one story that I so related to and I so loved. You are cast in Saturday Night Live, which is a new show. You only think it's going to be 13 weeks. You're mm-hmm. told it's going to be 13 weeks. Like people are like, Saturday Night Live did not start out with what we think of it as now. It was not the Parthenon. It was on
Saturday nights. It was an experiment.
Yeah. On Saturday nights in the 70s, they used to just run a rerun of The Tonight Show.
Mm-hmm. NBC exactly.
said, let's do something with that spot. And they gave it to this Canadian producer, Lorne Michaels, and it was an experiment. And you literally, it was... You're like, yeah, sure. I'll go to New York for 3 months. That'll be fun. And then I'll go back to the Groundlings. And it's the mid 70s, early 70s, really 74. You go to New York and you're how old?
23.
Yeah, you're a baby. You're a baby. And you go to New York and you're like, hey, I'm in this show. This is good. I'm getting paid. It was literally like a paid gig. Like, hey, yeah, I got a paid gig. This is good. And what I can only describe as an orgasm of bad ideas.
They, yes.
They're like, let's have all the cast do their, even though you've gotten the job, we want you to audition for the writers.
Well, that wasn't a bad idea, though, Dana. I thought Lauren was perfectly reasonable because he had
let me tell you why I think it was.
Oh, okay, go ahead.
All the writers as a writer are jealous of you for being in the cast.
Oh.
And so they think that they're all funnier than you.
Mm.
And they don't know why they're not in the cast.
I see.
And so they're not going to give it up if they don't really have... And this is, by the way, as people mature and grow up, they get over this. But I'm assuming that this was the beauty of this group is that you were all very young and green mm-hmm. and new and hungry and feral. But I think a lot of those people were like, oh.
Show me.
So
yeah.
you're set up to fail. You're set up to fail. And then in that failure, you're going to go into the show with less confidence than you had before.
That's exactly. You've really distilled the important elements of my very first beginning there at the show. Yeah, I really felt 1,000 pegs down. And it would have been better if they didn't know. And it was just like a gradual reveal of all the characters that I could do. And as I said in the book, you know, it's like I had at least 6 solid characters that caused Lorne to hire me twice. But I don't even want to imagine what the writers saw during that presentation, because I had been robbed when I first got there, and all my written material was in the car.
Yeah, literally, so I had all of your. And when you say robbed,
everything.
It's not like somebody stole your joke. Well, somebody literally stole your act. Your life was in your car.
Exactly.
Your car got stolen.
Exactly.
And you literally went into this situation naked, and what you say was so. God, I have been there. Your mouth is so dry, you're peeling your lips off your teeth.
Yes.
God, that was evocative.
Oh my God. And, you know, trembling, freezing, even though it might not be cold in the room. You know, stage fright is just it's a big thing in my life. And it's a through line in terms of, I mean, even now, if I have to speak publicly, I have to take a beta blocker.
Really?
Absolutely. Because I just, you know, my mind is almost like, you know, when you try to start a motorcycle or you know, one of those pull string on the lawnmower, that's what mm-hmm. my mind turns into. And I can't find words that we would know.
Sure, I understand. I have to take a beta blocker if I have to speak privately. But if I'm...
Yeah, well, thank you for telling me that, Dana. I feel closer to you.
Well, I do, because it did feel like, to me, like, yeah, this is the experience I would have had too, you know?
At 23. I mean, I saw your one-man show. How old were you? It was 1990?
24.
Okay. I mean,
No. 6. 26.
Either way. I mean, that was intense material. It was hilarious, but it was also incredibly dark. And you exposed a lot. For those of you who cannot see what Dana is doing, he's kind of making the gesture of make them laugh, make them laugh, you know.
Yeah.
But it was really very revealing. And so I didn't get any sense of stage fright coming off of you. And I would have had it because of the nature of what I was allowing people to see about me.
Right. But you do, but you're very in the book, you're very open and honest about your struggles with addiction, your struggles with insecurity, and your struggles
lack of experience.
Lack of experience. You did not, in your opinion of you, you did not ripen as a performer until long out of your biggest exposure.
Exactly. That's a beautiful way of putting it. In fact, yeah. I was about to tell you this listener's review of my book on Audible, which he gave me 5 stars for everything. And then the first sentence was, from the least compelling cast member. And so, you know, if I was able to rise above that, you know, I feel like I did a good job. I can be gratified at that.
But yeah, well, that's the Albert Brooks has the word, and I can't think of it's a mix of a compliment and an insult, and I'm not sure of it. But it's like,
oh yes, God,
it has. Of course, it's of course that you. Of course, you have to shit on me before you go. I'm dying to know what kind of parent you are.
Yeah. Oh dear.
But you were in the Groundlings when it was just starting out.
Yes.
And you're friends with this guy, Lorne Michaels, and you go to New York. And we're cutting right to the SNL stuff, but I do want to talk about your childhood in Beverly Hills, which is fascinating. But what the first thing that struck me is you kind of follow this guy, your friend in New York, and you're doing this thing. And then it must have been like putting together, like you're not aware that the country is going to be watching you. You're just 20 or 40 people you're going to put on a TV show.
Exactly. You can never be aware of that. There were a lot of people before we went on the air. A lot of the cast members were talking about how nervous they were at the prospect and awareness that a million people might be watching us. And I had been on TV before, just, you know, doing Lily's show. And I knew that it's really, you're only aware of the audience that's right there. You'll never, ever have that, you know, looming over your shoulder as an awareness.
Right.
So I think there were 300 people in the audience. That was, you know, who we were playing to and how we were able to gauge how well we were doing.
Yeah. And at the time, the Groundlings sat.
Oh, God, 30 people.
Yeah. But still, it's like 300 to 300. That's manageable. That's a full comedy club.
Yeah.
300 people. Yeah. You don't see beyond that. But you find pretty quickly that you are on a rocket ship.
Yeah.
And in that rocket ship, you sort of become hermetically sealed within it.
Mm-hmm.
Or it drives you crazy, I would think.
Well, it's your world because of the hours. Belushi called it the vault, Studio 8H. And it was like Vegas. There were no clocks anywhere.
Right.
You couldn't get a sense of what time it was. But, you know, I have to think that it was par for the course of any TV show, except that it was live. And, you know, our schedule was incredibly intense. There was no time to really do anything, go anywhere. The only restaurant we had access to was Pastrami and Things, which was in the lobby. So that was where we ordered from when we did our first Seder at SNL.
Wow.
Which
Because I often think, like, wow, you were in New York in 1975, 6, 7. And then I immediately go to, oh my God, the bands that you must have seen. But you were also working. Like you were, hey, let's go down to CBGB's and see the Ramones. No, you had a job. You couldn't go to CBGB's and see the Ramones.
I actually did find a couple of times. I think, what was the place? it might have been CBGBs, and I remember, but these people were in the audience, like Iggy Pop and David Bowie were in the audience to see Sam and Dave.
Wow.
That was one of the times I made my way out, and I think I'd gone to...
Sam Cedar and Dave Cross, we should say.
That's right. I think I went, oh God, I can't remember the name of these clubs, but I had seen Todd Rundgren somewhere, and lots of really great bands, but also we were privy to, this is something that the show doesn't really do anymore, which I wish they would, which is we would break bands. You know, nobody had ever seen Elvis Costello or Devo. And that was a wonderful thing. But then we'd also have these incredibly iconic bands like The Band or The Stones or George Harrison. And we were very aware of how lucky we were and how exciting it was.
Yeah, when the Rolling Stones come to the show, it's like, oh, okay, I'll speak. That'll be cool.
Yeah.
I remember we put Elvis Costello into an episode of The Simpsons because we wanted to meet him.
And he did it? He
was gracious enough to come say to R.E.M. R.E.M. is in my first episode that I wrote because I wanted to meet them.
And how exciting.
And then they come and you're like, oh, hey, how's it going?
Yeah. They will never know.
Yeah. And then you go outside. You're like,
and you'll, that's wonderful.
But I will say, and you'll appreciate this, the person that I found out was doing the show and I ran over to the recording studio to meet them, Patrick McGoohan.
Of course, the prisoner.
He's here today?
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
And he had a show, A Secret Agent Man, before that.
Secret Agent Man, yeah.
Which was so good. I loved that show.
And he turned down James Bond because he was Catholic and didn't like his sexuality.
My God. I remember seeing there's a great restaurant on the Santa Monica Pier that has been remodeled and turned into something entirely different, but it was called The Lobster, and it was this little tiny, it was a house, literally a house, but the food was really good, and I remember seeing Patrick McGoohan there. This is when I was a kid, and probably a teenager, and he was a little bit red-faced drunk, but he was really pissed because he didn't know that they only took cash.
Oh, funny.
So it was... It was seeing Patrick McGoohan getting mad at a waiter was something I never expected. But, you know, that's what it's like when you live in Los Angeles.
I once helped Bruce Dern get out of a parking garage.
I don't understand how to put the ticket in here.
Oh, my God.
And I was just driving in. I didn't work at the parking garage.
Dear diary. Nice.
Hang on. I'm not doing Bruce Dern properly.
I don't know how to put the ticket in here.
That's pretty good. Wow.
I'm doing Rick Overton's Bruce Dern. Your parents were not in the business.
That's right.
But you grew up eyeball deep in the business.
In the sense that I went to school with the kids of movie stars and celebrities. And so I had the opportunity
in the 60s.
Pardon me?
You grew up in Beverly Hills in the 60s. Like,
yes.
People, a modern reference would be if you saw Once Upon a Time in Hollywood, that was your teenager.
That's exactly it.
Teenagerhood.
Exactly. And it was the 60s. So it was, you know, the British invasion. Rodeo Drive, although it wasn't like the shopping mecca that it is today, it was still a very happening place. And it's the place that I saw Fred Astaire walking down the street. And it was the home of the Daisy Club, which was the first, to the best of my knowledge, membership disco. And, or discotheque, as we called them in those days, Dana.
Learned about the Daisy Club in the other audiobook that I'm listening to. The two of the best audiobooks of the year, listening to them concurrently. The Big Goodbye, which is Sam Wasson's audiobook about the making of Chinatown. And he goes back and starts with Roman Polanski and Sharon Tate moving to LA.
Oh, Jesus Christ. Wow. I'm going to get
and
that.
LA, and that LA was, until 1969, a very different town.
It's very provincial, I guess you would say.
And it really was the Manson murders that changed the town.
Yeah. Well, it was also, I think, the beginning of the end of the Summer of Love.
Right.
When drugs turned from, you know, a spiritual thing to just making people incredibly angry and crazy.
Yeah, it was the you know, the day must end and the darkness must come. And it was, it was the flip side to the sun. Yeah, it was when that became, when the 60s became spooky.
I do talk about being at the murder house where the whole crime happened, when a friend of mine took me to meet a manager. And as we're driving up there, I see a street sign that says Cielo Drive. Thinking, why, that's, I know, how do I know? And then, you know, because there had been photos of the house so much in the news, especially when I was a teenager, I recognized it. And it was owned by this guy that I was meeting. And how he could still live in it, I won't know. But he was the kind of person, you know, he sued Polanski because there had been so many pictures of his house because of the crime that he couldn't sell it. Well, so we sued Polanski because of that. I beg your pardon?
Roman Polanski's got a pretty dodgy past, but I wouldn't blame him for that.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly.
Yet it was only demolished in like the 90s, I think. It was because Trent Reznor rented it, I know. And
he did?
Yeah, he recorded an album there, I think, which is like...
Well, that makes sense. Yeah. Jeez. Yeah. Wow.
But
although I love him, I think
sure, but it's like, yeah, that's the coolest thing I've ever heard of a 13-year-old doing.
Yeah.
But all of these iconic Forrest Gump moments, you were at the Beatles Hollywood Bowl concert.
Yeah, and Dodger Stadium. And when we did the 40th anniversary show, Paul McCartney was the only Beatle I hadn't met. So we're on home base at the end, the good nights and everything. And I'm standing in front of him and I said, oh, I saw you at Hollywood Bowl and Dodger Stadium. And my friend Brian Ray is in his band. And he later told me McCartney thought I meant wings.
That's so funny.
Is that strange?
You had another band. How did you meet? Now, I know you met George Harrison on the show.
Yeah.
Imagine you met Ringo Starr through show business.
Yeah, my good friend of mine was his manager.
How did you meet John Lennon?
Well, I didn't actually meet him, but I had an encounter with him where let me set the stage for you, Dana. I was coming from a photo shoot with Francesco Scavullo, who was a huge photographer at that time and was really represented the look of the cover of Cosmopolitan magazine, all those photos. And
he did my Cosmo cover.
He did?
Yes, he did.
Wow, cool. So I'm in full makeup from that, going through the lobby, going to read through. I think Jill Clayburgh was the host that week. And out of my peripheral vision, I see these two forms that come into focus, and it's John and Yoko. And as they pass in front of me, John turns, smiles, waves at me, and says, "Hi, Lorraine." So that, and I describe in the book, was like a, you know, Abbott and Costello meet Frankenstein moment where I, you know, no saliva left in the mouth. Sure. And it was like, he just said, Yeah. So that's, I would just say it was an encounter, not exactly meeting him.
No, you officially met him. You officially, that counts.
Okay. Thank you.
I stood next to Paul McCartney backstage at the Jimmy Kimmel show, and I had nothing to say.
What can you say?
Yeah.
I'm glad you kept your hair. I mean,
and yeah, he's taller than I thought. And, but I just like, yeah, there's nothing. Yeah.
Just waiting.
Yeah. There's nothing. Yeah. And I was, and afterwards I was really glad I didn't say anything.
There
was one of those few times where I went, you played that right.
I've learned the hard way, to follow my instinct on that. When I was still doing the show, Jane Curtin, I think, had done a play with Joanne Woodward, so she knew Paul Newman. Now, my twin brother's name is Paul Newman, and growing up, we would get people calling our house because my brother was listed.
And you're a twin. Thinking, I didn't know you were a twin.
Oh, you didn't know that? Oh, yeah.
No, I didn't know you. I know Tracy, but I didn't know you were
a twin. Yes. Yeah, my brother is a really gifted musician and songwriter. But Paul Newman was at a restaurant with a bunch of people talking, and I was so excited, I just ran over to him and, you know, blurted what I thought would be incredibly interesting to him, because it was to me.
Sure.
But, I mean, the look he gave me was so withering. and you know, Joanne was so sweet because she knew Jane and she knew what I was feeling and was trying to kind of diffuse the discomfort of the moment. But man, it was a withering look of like, I'm eating. I'm with friends. I don't care. You know? And why should he?
And it's true, but it is but here's the thing. There's a time in your life when you went through this where everyone you meet goes,
yeah,
gasps. I mean, that must have been, was that because you're in the vault, was that, did that occur slowly, or did you suddenly find, like, you know, I went out of the building today and I couldn't walk a block without people stopping me?
Well, in all honesty, and I write about this in the book, I was a little more anonymous than the rest of the cast. I was able to, I would say, you know, 30% of the time that wouldn't happen. But it was pretty exciting when it did.
Well, except at that time, you had a lot of hair.
I did. I
was not, like, that you don't have hair now, but you had like a lot of...
I was a furry freak brother.
Yeah.
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 I was like a Q-tip that had gotten used.
You're like, but, a Q-tip that was on fire.
Uh-oh. I never knew what to say, because quite often people, and they still do say, you look like Lorraine Newman. And I defy you to have a rejoinder for that. I don't know, you know, other than, well, I am.
Yeah.
You know.
He must be very attractive.
Yeah, it'd be like, you know, oh, you're Lorraine Newman. I loved Gilda Radner. It's like, yes, I loved.
So did I.
Loved her too. Yeah. So it's not. I don't really think that, as an individual, I achieved the kind of success that the other cast members did. I never felt that. And I know why, you know, and it was because I was the captain of my own ship. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I was determined not to repeat characters, man, because that would be a sellout. And it made me less memorable. And it was hard to categorize me.
They're true tales.
In the 1940s, Bill Killebrew moved from his hometown of Dresden, Tennessee, to the big city of Memphis. Bill was an amateur cartoonist. He had no formal training, but he was talented. He was hired to create advertising for the local basketball team in Dresden. He drew cartoons for the local newspaper, but this was the local newspaper in Dresden, Tennessee, and Bill felt he was destined for better things. And so he set out for the big lights of Memphis and got a job for the Memphis Light, Gas, and Water Department, working in the Hydrant Engineering Division. And what that meant was Bill Killebrew got paid to draw pictures of fire hydrants. The year was 1949. And television was just starting out. In Memphis, Tennessee, there was a record store called Ferguson's Record Shop. And Ferguson's was sponsoring a TV show. And this TV show was showing records playing in Ferguson's Record Shop. That was the show. It's a great idea if you like music, but television
is a visual medium, and watching records play on a turntable wasn't very exciting. Enter Bill Killebrew. The show was called Spinning Images, and when you turned it on in 1949, you would hear all the musical hits of the day. It was like having a radio station on your TV set. But what you would see on your screen was a black dot. And from that dot would emerge a line. And from that line would slowly form a drawing. This was created by pointing a camera at a sheet of glass that had paper taped to it. And behind that paper stood Bill Killebrew with a magic marker. That's it. TV magic. It sounds primitive, I know. Spinning Images ran for 10 years. In addition to Spinning Images, Bill became the advertising manager for a local bread company called Hart's Bread. And Hart's Bread sponsored a local kids' cartoon show called, wait for it, Hartoon Time. See what they did there? Hartoon Time was a prime example of a local kids' show in that era. There was a studio audience of children, and the host, hey, guess who the host was? It was Bill Killebrew, that's who, now calling himself Cap'n Bill Killebrew, C-A-P apostrophe N, and he would come out, interview the kids, draw pictures, and show cartoons, just like Boston's Rex Trailer. Perfecto. What more do you need? Well, obviously, you need a monkey. Now, details are sketchy, but somehow, Bill Killebrew acquired a chimpanzee named Scatter. Scatter appeared on Hartoon Time and was an instant hit, becoming the show's star attraction instantly, so much so that the show changed its name to Scatter's World. But chimps are a lot of hard work, and Scatter, and his brother Chatter, were no exception. After about a year, Bill Killebrew needed to lighten the load, and he went searching for a new home for Scatter. But who in Memphis, Tennessee, in the 50s, was crazy enough and wealthy enough to buy and, more importantly, care for a chimp? Wait a minute.
Too much monkey business. Too much monkey business.
Elvis. That's who. Joe Esposito, who was a member of Elvis's posse of friends called the Memphis Mafia. And he told this story to Memphis Magazine.
Oh, we kept Scatter around the house. We had a cage for him, but he was not used to being caged, and when released would play havoc with the ladies. As much as a terror as Scatter was, he was also capable of behaving like a gentleman. Alan Fortas, he used to love taking Scatter for a drive in the Rolls Royce and buying him little suits, and he tried to teach him how to drive in that Rolls Royce. Now, Scatter wasn't very tame, by all accounts. Then again, what chimp is, really? Joe continues, one night, we had a little get-together, and Patty Perry was a guest. And Patty didn't know about Scatter. Well, Scatter come out, and he makes a beeline for Patty. His arms are waving, and he's screaming. And Scatter's trying to look up her dress. Well, Patty tell him to stop. But Scatter was determined to get his way with Pat. She told Scatter, you do that one more time, and I'll knock the hell out of him. Well, naturally, Scatter did it again, and Pat got on her knees and hit that chimp under the chin. And Scatter did a backflip, landed on the couch, dazed, and he looked up at her in disbelief. He ended up with a bump on his head, size of a golf ball. Now, that's a terrible story, no matter how you look at it. It's only mitigated by the fact that Patty Perry ended that evening with her face intact. Neither Elvis nor anyone in the Memphis Mafia was trained in how to handle wild animals, of which Scatter most certainly was. A young chimpanzee is not a dog. You can't just throw it in the car and take a trip. Tell that to the Memphis Mafia. Marty Lacker said, Scatter was with us on my first trip cross country. We had him in a cage in the back of the Chrysler station wagon, and one night we checked into a motel in Flagstaff, Arizona. The chimp stayed in Alan and Lamar's room, and all night long we hear Scatter going bada boom, bada boom, bada boom, bada boom, just running back and forth, back and forth, back and forth, all over the room. Well, next morning, Lamar, he says, in this real quiet voice, he said, "You need to come in here and see this." Scatter had gotten up on the drapes and started swinging on them, and they were all pulled down, and he shit all over them. Oh, God, it was a mess. Lamar said Scatter was just throwing everything he could find. He even shit in his hands and threw it on the walls. I said, "How do you think we're going to get out of here without paying for all this?" And Lamar said, "Don't worry about it." So we just closed the door and went and had breakfast at the restaurant across the way. Memphis Mafia member Lamar Filk picks up the story. Again, this is all from Memphis Magazine, and my guess is Lamar Filk sounds a lot like the other guys. Let's find out. "Well, just about the time our food..." Yeah, he does. He does. Sounds just like him. "Just about the time our food came, I look out the window and I say, 'Oh my God.' The maid was knocking on the door of our motel room, and we all jumped about the same time and tried to yell at her, but it was too late. Before we could even get out of our chairs, the maid walked in and closed the door and started making up the room. Now, it was early morning. Room was dark. Well, you can picture what it was like for a maid to open a motel room door in Flagstaff, Arizona, and find a chimp inside. Scatter ran across the room, and he just latched onto her, and she went bananas. She started screaming and the most blood-curdling yell I ever heard, and we ran over there. The maid came flying out the room with Scatter wrapped around her like a boa constrictor, and he jumped on her back and fastened his legs around her waist and put his hands over her eyes so she couldn't see. Well, we had to peel Scatter off the maid, and then he bolted out the door, went tearing out across the porte cochere, which ran over the shed in front of the hotel." So he says hotel, but can say porte cochere. Lamar. "He went right up the drain pipe and up over the top. Now, the maid was still screeching. Scatter was on the roof, dancing up a storm and laughing at us. Well, Alan says, 'What are we going to do?' And I said, 'Go get in your car.'" Again, these guys sound a lot alike. "I'll go get the station wagon. I'll leave the back door open and the windows down and the door to the cage ajar. And we'll just slowly drive off." Well, that car hadn't rolled 10 feet. Scatter was on that sucker. He thought we were going to leave him. And he stuck so tight, he looked like adhesive tape. Again, there are no heroes in that story. Now, Elvis had a house in L.A. for when he was making movies. It was in Bel Air, specifically, on Bellagio Road. And wherever Elvis went, the Memphis Mafia followed. And along with the Memphis Mafia, naturally or unnaturally, came Scatter. To the surprise of no one, Scatter was a disaster. He bit strangers. He bit the household staff. Elvis's butler, after a particularly nasty bite, threatened to quit. Another night, Scatter climbed the fence into the neighbor's property and interrupted a dinner party by running through their house, waving his hands over his head and shrieking at the top of his lungs, which is a terrifying thing to witness if you're expecting a chimp at your Bel Air dinner party. Imagine if it's a surprise. Eventually, Scatter was banned from Bel Air altogether and sent back to Memphis. Of course, Elvis and the gang were in Los Angeles basically all the time making movies, so Scatter was left to fend for himself, relegated to the back room of the mansion, fed by the house staff, ignored, discarded. Not a great life. Wouldn't it be wonderful if someone in this story had a fucking brain and put Scatter in a sanctuary where he could live a semi-normal life with other chimps? Wouldn't it be great if the story could end with a big fat, "And he lived happily ever after"? Well, no such luck. Scatter eventually passed away at Graceland, a toy that a child had grown tired of. Well, chimpanzees aren't toys. They are fascinating, intelligent, marvelous animals, but they are also wild, strong, unpredictable, and most assuredly not a pet. There is a silver lining to this story. Never again would a wealthy pop star make a pet of a chimpanzee.
At the height of Michael's popularity, A young chimpanzee named Bubbles was one of his closest and most trusted companions.
Oh, right. Shit.
Too much monkey business for me to be involved in.
You're harder on yourself than you need to be. And I can say as the...
Here's the king of that.
is the king of that for sure. But also as somebody who, I mean, I was your audience. I was in high school during the heyday of your show. Mm-hmm. And I had Steve Martin's Best Fishes poster in my bedroom and the Blues Brothers poster in my bedroom.
Oh, yeah.
I was a comedy student and a freak. And, you know, I would watch the show and then I would perform the show in homeroom on Monday.
Oh, fantastic.
I was the audience. And yes, my favorite cast member was Dan Aykroyd. John Belushi was the public's favorite because he was the most type A male energy spot.
Right.
But by and large, you were all of a piece. It is like picking your favorite Beatle. Yeah, my favorite Beatles, Paul, but they're all in the Beatles.
Yes, yes, I get
all,
that.
You all get the point. You all get the point.
And yeah.
And
over time, you know, my ego has been properly pummeled.
You're also Connie Conehead.
Yeah. So, yes.
You know, you're on the board.
Yeah. Yes. I'm part of the club.
Yeah. So
they
can't
take that away from me, Dana.
Yes. But that's what's so great about the book is that people go, yeah, this is who I would be. I have been told I was very close to the cast. To getting in the cast. I've also been told that everyone has been told that. I also think that I would have been a train wreck on that. That I'm not cut out for that level of...
Well, the thing is that you're such a great writer.
Yeah, I don't think I'm cut out for that level of cutthroat competition. Oh,
they would have been lucky to have your Vincent Price, Dana.
They did eventually, but it was with Bill Hader.
Exactly.
And that's what counts.
Yeah. Lorne told me about when he hired Bill, he was just so impressed that someone Bill Hader's age had a Vincent Price impression.
Well, Bill is doing my Vincent Price impression. He did tell me that.
Great.
And he like confessed it to me like, look, you should know I had Funhouse and I'm doing you. And I was like, that's fine. I'm doing someone else's Vincent Price impression.
Sure.
My Vincent Price impression belongs to a guy whose name is literally Tom Sawyer.
I know Tom from Sketchfest, San Francisco. Yeah.
Well, I'm doing Tom Sawyer's Vincent Price. So Bill Hader is doing Tom Sawyer's Vincent Price through me. So it's like, it's fine. It's all good. As long as he's there, as long as he's being represented.
Well, see, I love knowing that because that means that he was just as much a student of comedy as we were.
Totally.
You know?
Oh, no. Bill is absolutely. He's the same guy. And he's a big monster nerd, too.
I know.
I took him to Bob Burns' house, and he was flummoxed.
You know, you never took me to Bob Burns' house,
Dana. I'll take you to Bob's house. Take you to Bob's house the minute COVID's done.
Isn't it too late?
Nope.
Is he still doing that?
Yeah.
I'm begging you.
I can do it.
I am begging you to take me there sometime.
Oh, sure. Yeah.
I've had my shots.
It's all there, and Well, that's you're a monster nerd, which is another delightful thing, and you got to work with Christopher Lee, and Christopher Lee told you a great fart story, which
yes, and I really do struggle with that in terms of like when I think about. There are just two kinds of people, two kinds of women, especially those that think that's funny and those that don't. And I always wonder, you know, how that makes me look that I do. But there it is, you know, that story.
I don't traffic with people that don't.
You don't truck with them?
I don't truck with them. No, the date story that
Mark?
That your children would make you retell.
Yes. The peeing in my pants.
Yeah, the peeing in your pants story, which you don't have to recount.
I won't.
There's a book by Jonathan Ames called What's Not to Love. And in that book, he has a story called I Shat My Pants in the South of France. And it is one of the funniest things I've ever read in my life. Your story, where you pee your pants on a date, it is as funny as that.
And and yeah, and it's just like, you can't tell me it's not funny. That's the
I know, exactly.
You can't tell me that's not funny.
But the thing with Christopher Lee is that he was such a great raconteur. And he was the way I was in terms of his fascination with dialects, and he would just volunteer shit like, you know, do you want to hear my South African accent? I've been working on it. And he did an amazing one. But he did tell the story about having done live TV. And this one time he had a line. It was a military drama. He had this line, is that the best you can do? Upon his entrance, he had that line. And he was working with a Spanish actor. I don't know why he made the distinction of saying he was Spanish, who right during Christopher Lee's entrance, as he opens the door, the Spanish actor, as according to Christopher Lee, lets out the most booming fart. And then he has the line, is that the best you can do? On live TV. So that was a great thing to hear from Christopher Lee. He was just, he was so warm and so funny.
Yeah.
And it's so delightful when you see that. And I think a lot of, you know.
And he's really funny, and people don't appreciate that he's funny.
I know. There's a lot of dramatic, you know, actors that are incredibly funny.
He's great in the movie Serial. With Martin Mull and Tuesday Weld, based on the Syra McFadden novel about Marin County.
I vaguely remember that movie, and I forgot he was in it.
He plays the...
That's right, a gay biker. That's right, with the leather vest and no shirt. Yeah. I have to see that again.
Yeah, and he's great. Yes, my men aren't pansies, Holroyd. We are tough dudes. But also interesting about Christopher Lee, he was in the special services for the British Army in World War II. He did some shit.
Yeah.
There's a story, you may know this story, in the culmination of the Lord of the Rings trilogy, Saruman gets stabbed in the back, and Peter Jackson goes, and just go like, oh! And Christopher Lee goes, no, I wouldn't. Do you know the sound a man makes when he's stabbed in the back? And Peter Jackson goes, no, do you? And he goes, yes, they don't make any noise.
Oh my God. That reminds me of that scene in Inglourious Basterds.
Yes.
When, what is the name of that actor? He's like slowly being stabbed and going, no, 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 no. And the Nazi officer's going, yes, shh, 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 as he's just slowly plunging the knife in him. That was one of those things.
Albert Brooks does a great version of that in Drive when he's killing Bryan Cranston and he just goes, hard part's over. The hard part's over.
God. Yes. Oh.
Whoever thought Albert Brooks would be doing one of the most chilling on-air murders?
Exactly. There you go again.
There's a story that Albert Brooks was offered the permanent hosting job of.
That's true. You know, yeah.
And turned it down.
Yes. Well, there were other people in the Groundlings that were offered the show and turned it down because they were kind of jaded from doing all these summer replacement shows and they thought, eh, this won't go.
Right.
So they turned it down.
So the show runs for 5 years.
Mm-hmm.
And the last season... It was almost like, as a viewer of the show, it was like a half season because John and
Danny,
Dan Aykroyd had left,
right,
and Harry Shearer joined the cast. And
that's right, Peter Aykroyd.
But you leave the show. I did not know that you guys were offered to remain for the 1980 season.
Yes. They went to us all individually and asked us, but I knew that I didn't want to do it without Lorne. I don't want to cast aspersions on other people, but
no,
I knew that the,
I totally get
the
it.
Person that they had was not someone I felt could offer the show anything near what Lorne offered it.
Right. Yeah. And people forget that season, the 1980 season, the show almost went off. The show almost died.
Yes, if it weren't for Eddie Murphy. That's right.
Yeah.
I can't even imagine what those actors went through. I mean, the good news and the bad news.
I know them all.
Yeah.
Not personally, Gilbert. But I just remember that. Well, Gilbert, Charles Rocket, Gail Mathias, Denny Dillon, clearly don't know them all, but I think Brad Hall might have been in that season.
Denny Dillon was in a sketch on our show when we were on. She played a nun, and it was a bit that she did with her partner, and it might have been in the new talent spot. Wow. I don't know if it's still in the compilation, but yeah, she was on our show when we were doing it.
Yeah, I know people that know Charles Rocket through the art world.
Why the art world?
I have a friend named Bruce Helander, who was who's a collage artist who was the dean of RISD. Years ago, and I think
Rhode Island.
Charles,
yeah,
I think Charles went to RISD, or he knew Charles through RISD. And
it's like the Beatles. He has an art background.
Exactly. And you know, it was just like Charles was tall and handsome. They go, yeah, he'll be the new Chevy Chase. He looks like him.
He was good, too.
Yeah. No, it was.
But he had mental illness, too, which is so sad.
Yeah. As Thomas Berger wrote in Little Big Man, sometimes the magic works, sometimes it doesn't. Mm. You know, sometimes the show comes together, sometimes it doesn't.
Yeah.
But the point that I wanted to make for you is you're a giant star. And everyone thinks you're a giant star. Mm-hmm. And you go back to L.A. and you got nothing to do.
That's right. No game plan.
So, boy, as if I may quote the book, doing cocaine, smoking cigarettes, and waiting for the sun to come up.
Yeah, and hating it too. Hating the sound of those fucking birds.
Yeah, I've had that without the cocaine and the cigarettes, but just my brain going, yeah, not tonight. We're not going to sleep tonight.
Oh, the 11 days that you didn't sleep.
Yeah.
Oh, my God. Well, I also had grown up, as you know, in Los Angeles, and I quite often saw actors that I knew had been on a series and weren't on one anymore. And, you know, they all looked wounded and ashamed.
Yeah.
And I, of course, took that on too, but I also felt that it was my fault.
Sure.
You know, and it was certainly in some ways my doing, but I just, you know, I had no business sense at all. I was doing looping, you know, post-production sound and, you know, getting paid scale. So I had gone from this show that was incredibly huge to doing stuff off camera for scale. And don't think it was lost on me. It wasn't.
No, and you're seeing Bill, Danny, John.
Oh, yes.
And your co-stars, some of them, mm-hmm. are the biggest stars in the country at that point.
Yes.
They ran comedy.
Absolutely. And it's still and other to people, this day. You
know, Gilda and Jane specifically
had an amazing TV career.
Right. But wasn't a movie star, didn't seem interested in. I mean, Jane always is the anomaly of that cast of like, she seems to be the one that came to the show as a fully formed person.
That's well put. Absolutely. Yeah. And she didn't take any shit.
Didn't take any shit, knew it was bullshit. And, you know, because that's the thing, at the end of the day, it's all bullshit. Mm-hmm. And it doesn't matter.
It's hard to imagine that anybody isn't, to some extent, plagued by their ego. But if Jane was...
It's what drives you.
Yeah. You know? But if Jane was, you never knew it.
Sure.
You know, she was going to do what she wanted to do. And God, I admired her for that.
Yeah.
And she did great.
Yeah, and she was the one that went home at night to her husband and didn't...
Exactly.
Yeah.
But so, yeah, I was there and I was kind of like doing all these stage shows, which gave me experience. You know, I built towards the experience that I have now that make me the kind of performer I wish I had been when I had this monumental opportunity. And I think that... I don't think I've ever read a book where that's talked about.
Mm-hmm. No, it's so galvanizing, and that's why I like it more than Steve's book, because I share in Steve's book, I know that the world that he is climbing through, and I know what it's like to stand alone on stage and tell jokes on a second show Friday. But with your book, it's so full of human vulnerability. Mm-hmm. Which Steve, being from Orange County,
yeah,
and that's not.
I don't
fault.
Think we'll ever as know the, say, the inner world of.
Yeah, as they say, geography is destiny. It can be. They're from Orange County, and that's what happens.
No, and I appreciated his book because he also does talk about the techniques and the approach to how he created his style and his content, which was fascinating. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I love reading books that have that. And I endeavored to do the same thing in the sense that I wanted to celebrate and talk about all the comics that I saw growing up and even subsequent to that, you know, how they informed the subsequent style that I had in my work.
Yeah. The thing that I did take away from Born Standing Up that you, because you always worked in the Groundlings and in ensemble cast repertoire, didn't have to contend with, was had a different version of it, but the crushing loneliness of the life of a touring stand-up comedian.
The road. Oh, I can only imagine.
Yeah. The first day, especially when you have children, that first day is always a punch in the nose. But you had your own, you had the embracing loneliness of the act.
Yes, but also, you know, I don't understand
saying,
this.
As Steve Earle sang, my old friend, the blues.
Always there. But I had wonderful friends and I had very famous friends. Mm-hmm. So I was included in these kind of A-list parties.
Yeah.
But I did not feel accomplished.
And that's the thing that I want to know if you realize I want to know if you were aware of that at the time. Bill Murray, who's your very good friend, he's doing Stripes, and you're doing Looping.
Yes,
but he doesn't give a shit.
No, of course not.
No, I have friends. I have friends that I'm like. That are more successful than me and less successful than me. I don't care what they're, I want them to be healthy and happy, but I don't care where their career's at.
Yeah, I don't either, but I didn't feel that could be afforded to me in reverse.
Especially because you're not even 30.
Yeah.
You know, yes. you're not even 30 yet, you know, and that's the thing that I made this comparison at the beginning of the interview, and it's really true that because the original cast of SNL to my generation was the Beatles of comedy. And like the Beatles, you lived a lifetime and then were done and you weren't 30 yet.
Yes.
You were 28 years old and 60.
Yeah. that's so true, but also 17. So that aspect, you know, unfortunately kind of ruled me and, you know, took me down some paths that certainly made for a good story in the book.
Starting in 1980, you're back in Los Angeles. You're famous for being Lorraine Newman. And your life is pretty desolate.
Mm-hmm.
And that's sort of, you know, as they all say, like, you know, that's when you stare into the pit and you discover who you are. It took a while.
It did. But I've been very lucky. And, you know, Alan Zweibel pointed this out to me because I, of course, repeatedly say, never saw the big picture. But he said, your story has a happy ending. And I do recognize that. It's just not in its entirety, but it does have a very happy ending. I mean, you know, my career is modest in terms of people who have a film career, but in terms of people who have animation work, I've done really well, for which I'm so grateful and so happy. And my kids are healthy. I mean, what more could I want?
And that's really what matters, you know. I was friends with Robert Schimmel, the comedian.
I remember Robert Schimmel.
Sure. And Robert, insanely funny. Mm-hmm. And I know his daughter, Jess. Robert was really into the metrics of his success. Like he, you know, that he was Howard Stern's favorite comedian and his numbers were here and his merch numbers were here and his Vegas bookings were here and his road bookings were here. And Robert, bless his heart, was very aware and dialed into the metrics of how successful he was. Mm-hmm. Then he died and the world moved on.
Yes.
And I think of that specifically with Robert, because I knew him well and we had discussions about it. But the world stopped for about an hour and tipped its hat and then it moved on. And none of that stuff mattered.
Yeah. And I've had a lot of friends die. A lot.
Yeah. Well, high profile.
Yeah. And so, you know, that is also has given me a perspective on that. But it's also just being from LA and growing up in the culture that I did. I think I've always known that a lot of that stuff is so important.
Yeah. It really does matter when you go home and you close the door.
Mm-hmm.
What's there?
Yeah.
You know? But John dying didn't scare you straight.
No.
It scared Robin up to Marin.
Yeah.
You know, that was when Robin went, I'm going to get out of LA.
Yeah.
But that was, for your generation, it seemed to be that was a demarcation point where a lot of people went, oh, these things can kill us.
Yeah. There wasn't anything funny about coke anymore.
Right.
Even though I think because it was not addictive physically, it was still considered something benign. But of course, and what's so ironic too is that John was afraid of needles. Someone else injected him. And I'm dead certain it was an accident. I think that everybody knows that it was.
Yeah.
But, you know, it just kills me when I think of what they're missing. You know, and in the case of Gilda, obviously through no fault of her own, it just kills me that my kids never got to know her.
Right.
And she never got to know them, how she would have loved them and how they would have loved her. This is the stuff that gives me a perspective on what's really important and valuable.
Yeah. And that's the whole point of the journey is to lead an integrated life.
Yes.
No. And you and again, it's life teaches you cruel lessons. You're not only with John, Michael O'Donohue, Phil Hartman. You know, one day you don't wake up. Your merch numbers don't matter.
Right.
You know, and but it's also if you the more you do integrate, the more you can enjoy. And it's just it's the more you enjoy the work, and that's the other thing that I'm so grateful to you for putting in the book. In addition to all of the stories of the psychological journey, that in that period of time, you also are so generous in lauding the creative explosion that was that show and the joy in, like, for me to learn the origin of the Fest Drunk Brothers.
Yeah.
Yes. which I was on Halloween in 1978.
Nice.
You know, it's like me and my best friend were the Fest Drunk Brothers on Halloween.
Oh, fabulous.
In 1978. But to learn the origin of it and to know that, like, the first time they did it, they didn't know it was going to work. You know, it was just like,
sure.
Well,
that was the you know, real gift
great
of the
comedy
show
inside baseball.
Yeah, and we got to do stuff that was us, you know. That's what made it feel almost like we were getting away with stuff, especially in the beginning. We had no idea that bringing forth our tone, our sensibility, our sense of humor, our characters, which had never been seen on TV before, even though you'd had things like your Show of Shows and, you know, Carol Burnett and all that kind of stuff and Laughing, it still didn't represent the kind of stuff that we brought to the culture.
And it was the only place on television where you could hear stuff that you knew you weren't going to hear during primetime.
Right.
You know, Pussy Whip.
Yeah.
And I remember, you talk about it in the book, I remember Lord and Lady Douchebag.
Oh, yes.
I remember that really clearly. And even then, you know, it was 1979, but there were three networks and UHF channels.
Like, yeah.
You hear it, you know.
Yeah, that was a pleasure.
Absolutely amazing. We didn't get to talk about Invaders from Mars. But I did want to just ask you a general question. I bet you're asked this in other interviews, but and you talk about it in the book, but you know, over the five seasons, you know, like there, what are the specific episodes that you, if people haven't seen the show, like that one, we really nailed it.
Well, I don't really talk about entire episodes because, it would have been hard for me to like watch every single episode. And you know, I did enough work just like trying to find my favorite sketches, which is really what I talk about. I couldn't say, every, you know, you can see it now when you watch the show, which I do, and I absolutely love it, that some weeks are better than others. Mm-hmm. Some weeks are absolutely inspired. But I couldn't say that about, I couldn't say that I know which one I would single out because I don't know every sketch within an episode.
Right. One of the things, I'll tell you that too, that as a viewer really ring. But the other thing that you guys did that they don't do now, in addition to the bands, they don't do it with the hosts. Like you wouldn't get Julian Bond hosting now, you know, which I thought,
right.
Or Buck Henry, or, you know, it's like,
which, yes,
you yeah. know, I think the show could sustain it.
Absolutely.
The show has enough ballast that it doesn't have to have whoever is current.
Yeah. They would do well with some character actors.
Yeah. In the early days of the show, for people that, you know, you can watch it easily now, the Robert Klein episode mm-hmm. was a very experimental episode, which ended with a giant lobster attack on the studio.
That's right. Michael O'Donoghue, where he gave me the wonderful privilege, because I said, you know, it drives me fucking crazy when people are fleeing and the woman trips. God damn it. You know, I'm not waiting for you. Yeah. And so he let me be the one that tripped in the sketch.
Yeah. And that was a really great, and Robert Klein is so underrated as.
Oh, absolutely. I Can't Stop My Leg was just.
Ugh, freakish. And as a sketch, I mean, he was in Second City, I believe, with Compass Boy. Grit. That's a great early episode. And I guess it was Steve Martin's maybe second hosting when it was the musical guest was the Blues Brothers.
Yes.
That was the Sergeant Peppers of the Beatles.
Okay. Like that. Let me go back and watch that.
That was when, as a viewer, as a kid in ninth grade or eighth grade, you know, that was that lived for the show. Mm-hmm. That was when everything, you know, it was like there, everything about that was five stars. You know, everybody every cylinder was on full, you know. And it was greater than the sum of its parts, you know, that one. And then
I got to go back and watch
that. And then the worst one would be Milton Berle's. Okay. So
which isn't available. So
it's really not available.
I don't think so.
We could talk all day and we didn't even get to Dwight Frye. Where we could go. So, you know, we could do
that was our bonding moment.
I know. We could do an OP Heggie run. We didn't get to Forrest Ackerman. You had a subscription to Famous Monsters.
Yes.
Gilbert and I go on I think it's in the Gilbert podcast that I did. It's two parts because we couldn't stop. At one point, and I think it's in the second part, we get into Heidi Saha.
Yeah, that'll be the second part because I listened to the first part.
Do you know who Heidi Saha is?
I don't.
Heidi Saha was a 12 or 13 year old girl that would go to early 70s monsters conventions dressed as Vampirella that Forrest Ackerman and Isaac Asimov had such an unhealthy interest in. They did a one-shot magazine of photos of her that today would place you into prison. And it was just sold through Captain Company, Heidi Saha. And she, look it up on Google. It is unbelievable. Oh. And it was just like 1974.
Wow.
Heidisaha. And it's
okay.
Like, oh, Forry, no.
No.
Other podcasts reach for the sky. Dana Gould Bauer.
We bear.
This has been the Dana Gould Hour, brought to you by The Internet. Music by Andy Paley, with Jake Posner behind the board. Produced by Jeff Fox. Graphic design and web production by Spencer Hunt and Segan Friend. Sound editing and post-production by Jalinda Palmer and Joe Napolitano. Hey, if you like the show, why don't you drop us a line at show@danagould.com. Tom Kenny speaking.
I'm a person, I'm a singer, I love to sing and DJ, boom, pizza, you want me, pizza, boom.